It is Saturday, November 25th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, our Week in Geek News and your calls.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
And welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we're doing geek news. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. The phone number is 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or contact us right now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks in the air with me. Miles Elam, technical trainer at Surf Control, Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA, and John Tracy, technical support engineer at Surf Control. Geeks, welcome to GeekSpeak.
We're a technical group, aren't we?
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a classic GeekSpeak, guys. It's been a while since we had all three of you on. And
This is actually the crew that started GeekSpeak.
Took it over for the Cruise Out group, yeah. Mm-hmm. 6 years now, guys.
That's it. I'm out of here.
And you've been paid a cent.
It's true. How many days is that?
We should count it up. I'm going to get the biggest check.
There's four more kids among the geeks than there used to be.
That's true. 6 years ago, there was four less human beings.
Well, all right. Among us.
There's a lot less human beings.
Wow, for geeks, we've been busy.
Yeah, for geeks, definitely. Let's start with geek news, or the week in geek, as we like to say. And Mr. Cleveland, I'll start with you, sir.
Yeah, well... Everybody got a few more rights this past week.
Yay! From the U.S. government?
From the Library of Congress.
Mm. And do tell.
They have issued some copyright exemptions that are kind of interesting, that are going to allow cell phone owners to break the software locks on their handsets they can move them to other carriers. So up to this point, you know, when you bought a singular cell phone or T-Mobile, you know, it was locked for that service. And it was against the law for you to break that lock, to get it unlocked.
Really?
Yeah. I
hadn't heard this. This is cool.
Although people did it, you know, and you could find services that would do it for you. It's kind of silly. You'd pay $30-$40 and some guy would press a few buttons on your phone and say, here you go.
Thank you.
But, you know, with enough digging, you could figure out how to do it yourself. Now you can do it legally. And I guess there are a couple lawsuits out there. That were currently pending just about that.
It's interesting because it seems like it's not exactly encryption, so it makes sense that it wouldn't be against the Millennium Copyright Act.
Well, no, it was against the Digital Millennium Copyright Act,
and
this is the exception to it, and that's why I'm not quite as overjoyed by it.
Who made this exception?
The Library of Congress.
How can the Library of Congress make an exception to a rule of...
Because they control copyright law.
I didn't know.
Well, Congress supports, controls copyright law, but the Library of Congress is one of those entities that determines what the exemptions are going to be. Whenever copyright law comes up, you have a group of interested parties, unfortunately none of them in the general public, but you'll have like the Library Association, you'll have the Library of Congress,
right.
You'll have the music and media
so
industry.
They're not changing the law, they're just introducing an exception. So these exceptions are only good for 3 years.
Right. So as the analogy is, we all walked down that dark alley, got mugged, and someone gave us back our shirt. So
you don't really like it. I'm taking it, Miles. You don't exactly agree with all the copyright.
Oh, I'm glad that, yes, I'm glad that we have this new right back, but
it's merely a start.
And let's be clear, the right to take something you own and change it. is what we got back.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
We got a few more, too.
We got a few more rights? Or what else?
You'd like to hear them.
Yeah, sure. List them out, man.
So now film professors can copy snippets from DVDs for educational compilations.
Wow, but what software would they use? Because all the software that does that is illegal. Interesting. So go on.
Blind people can use special software to read copy-protected electronic books.
Okay.
There are a couple of interesting ones. Two exemptions dealing with computer obsolescence. Computer and software and video games that require machines no longer available. Copy protection controls may be circumvented for archival purposes.
That's not exactly saying MAME is legal.
Not exactly.
But the idea would be that if you can't get the hardware anymore and you're emulating it and you had to crack it to emulate it.
Yep.
That's legal.
You have
like
a whole bunch
idea.
Of Atari 2600 cartridges, but you don't have the Atari 2600. You could use whatever means are necessary to get that data off the cartridge.
Imagine actually having to get the data off the cartridge.
MAME is a software that allows you to play old stand-up video.
Right.
Yeah. And Atari, and they did a lot of stuff, yeah.
And there's another one, too, that, you know, a lot of software requires dongles, small computer attachments that allow you to run software. Well, if your dongle's damaged and cannot be replaced, it allows you to break that encryption.
I love the idea software. That in these circumstances where it's, you know, basically absolutely necessary to crack it, yeah, it's okay to crack it. But the entire infrastructure that allows for cracking, yeah, everybody's being illegal there. Like, okay, cool, I can, you know, break my software if my dongle's missing, assuming that I'm okay with using all these efforts of these people that have been cracking it for years.
So what you need is software locksmiths. People
yeah,
who
know.
Are, you know,
licensed.
Certificated, licensed to break into software.
I like that idea. Wonder if the Library of Congress will issue those. That'd be nice.
And the final one lets researchers test CD copy protection technologies for security flaws and vulnerabilities. Kind of like the Sony BMG. They had their little copy protection scheme that actually introduced, a flaw into your computer for hacking.
Spyware.
You know, last week we were talking about the PlayStation 3. And I was talking to Miles about, like, what he liked and stuff, and he was really adamant, Sony's evil. And so so I was like, whoa, Miles, come on. I mean, they made one little mistake with the whole CD thing. But since you bring it up, Miles, do you really feel that way? Do you, like, that mistake that Sony made about putting a rootkit on CDs is such a blunder that they should be punished indefinitely?
Punished indefinitely? No. But I'm not giving them a free pass on it. And the fact that you have this back and forth between Blu-ray and HD-DVD and the fact that they're not working together and the fact that Sony repeatedly makes these technologies that work with almost no one else, like memory sticks.
Mm-hmm.
So that they're like, no, everyone else supports these specs that everyone can work together with, like SD, Secure Digital or Compact Flash, but no, we're going to have our memory stick. And it's going to be more expensive than everyone else's for the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does just rub you the wrong way.
So, I mean, it's not so much a, yes, I want them to go down. It's more along the lines of, why am I giving them my money?
Well, Miles, I appreciate you being the ethical geek because I can still, with a clear conscience, buy Disney films and know that you won't, and therefore I'm partially supporting this.
So, Sony, if you're listening, send Miles a PlayStation. All is forgiven.
So there were a few things that the Copyright Office rejected, and one of those was to allow the owners of DVD movies to convert their content to portable video players like the iPod. They rejected that.
They rejected the ability to do that.
Yes.
So you're not supposed to be able to burn a CD.
You're not allowed to take a movie that you own, a DVD, and convert it to a format that plays on your iPod yourself. Yeah, that's not
good.
So, you know, for these other ones that were allowed, don't do them until Monday because they don't take effect until the 27th. So,
<Good to know. laughs>
you know, if you decide, oh, I'm going to go, you know, put an old game on my cell phone after I unlock it,
you're listening.
Wait till Monday.
You're listening to Geek Speak. That's Sean Cleveland. Now we're going to go to John Tracy for the next news item, sir.
Good afternoon. Good morning, depending on where you are. Two things, both about MRO. I really into MRO because my dad...
What is MRO?
MRO stands for Mars Reconnaissance Observer.
Okay.
My stepdad, Joe Day, worked on one of the projects on it called Hi-Rise, which is this... Basically, it's a long broom, as he describes it, of CCDs that scan the Martian.
These are these great images from Mars of the planet.
Yeah, it's been returning some amazing images, the best images ever taken of Mars. And it's about in orbit now. So one of the things they used it for was NASA's recently lost contact with the Mars Global Surveyor, which has been in orbit since 1997, so almost 10 years. It's been a great success, fulfilled all its scientific missions and then tons more. It's brought us a lot of great discoveries on Mars. We lost contact with it. So they took MRO and they looked for it. They turned its cameras, its high-rise and other cameras up to see, okay, this is where that satellite should be. This is where that spacecraft should be. And couldn't find it.
Wasn't there.
So
probably a reason why they can't access it.
Right. So it was kind of cool that, and they're also going to try to transmit from the Global Surveyor. They're going to try to transmit codes that the Pathfinders, the explorers that we have, the rovers down on Mars, Spirit and Opportunity, they're going to try to broadcast something that they would be able to hear to detect if it's there. So it's kind of cool. We've got enough scientific instruments currently on Mars that they're all like trying to help each other out. It's kind
of
cool.
Neat. Like a Swiss Army knife of high expensive gear.
Yeah.
So, I think the Transformers got it.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, there is definitely something around Mars that eats spacecraft because we lose 2 out of 3 missions that we send to Mars.
I've been watching this show called Eureka, and in one of the episodes, this giant death ray beam thing fires and it's going for the moon and it misses a little bit. And they're like, "Yeah, but where'd it go?" And there's a shot of Mars, and all of a sudden, satellite goes because it's disintegrated. And all the satellites are like, "We have a problem."
That's so, what happened.
That's what it really is bad sci-fi shows.
The other thing that MRO has done, one of its primary missions actually, is to look for landing sites for different scientific experiments, and if we ever send a manned mission to Mars, landing sites for that. So they had this prime landing site for the Phoenix Explorer, which is a resurrected lander that we're sending to Mars.
Okay.
And they had this prime landing site. Yeah, there. That would be great scientifically. It looks flat. It looks fine. All the pictures we have of it, it's perfect. So they sent MRO over it. Well, MRO orbited over it. They took a bunch of pictures. They found out that it's strewn with boulders. MRO, the high-rise instrument, can see things down to 1 meter. A meter is, you can tell what that is at meter resolution. They have to look for boulders that size because if there's a boulder field, they can't land there.
Mm-hmm. So, that'd be bad.
Yeah, sure enough, they found like this massive boulder field, and it looked great from orbit from everything else. High-rise was able to tell that
your stepfather
you're gonna lose your thing.
Your stepfather's doing good work.
That's cool.
Yeah, he did.
Thank you for the space update, Mars.
So Alex wants to know why you didn't just say death ray.
What did I say?
You said sent a ray to.
I think I said death ray, didn't I? Super Death Ray? Maybe I said Super Death Ray.
That would be cool.
We'll have to listen to the podcast. Which, by the way, anyone can listen to their podcast, and please spread the word anywhere in the world. Go to geekspeak.org. Miles. Thank you, John.
So, I have some depressing news.
Mm.
There's a creationism museum to open next summer in Kentucky.
And Geekspeak will be sponsoring a field trip.
Can we put quotes around the term museum?
Well, I mean, you can have a museum.
Attraction.
Attraction. Good. Creation is attraction. Go on.
Yeah, the museum is costing $25 million to build.
Wow.
And all but $3 million has already been raised. So there's a lot of...
Wow, there's a lot of interest in this.
Yeah, a lot of support for this.
Okay, so what is this museum going to do? It's going to show like God and
Well,
and
it
Adam
has
the
motto
garden,
of prepare to believe. And a lot of the money is going into animatronic dinosaurs, which, of course, existed alongside of modern humans before the fall from grace.
So you're going to have giant, beautiful, robotic dinosaurs fighting cavemen?
Well, this is before then. They were getting along, so they're going to be passing each other daisies.
This is in the garden.
So...
What else?
Yeah.
I'm curious.
What else?
How far does the brainwashing go?
Well, I'm not quite sure, but with the exception of a few turtles swimming in an artificial pond... everything is entirely fake, not living, not based upon actual science.
If you're going to go with animals and you want and robotics, it does make sense to go with turtles because they're so long lived. So that makes sense. Your investment lasts a long time. But
so cavemen were naked back then. Are they going to display them naked?
I don't think so. They'll all have fig leaves, of course, because that's the paintings that still exist. But let me ask. Would any of you, like, I'm assuming all of us would kind of dig, like, working at Disney in all the robotics labs, right, and building up Lincoln and such. Would any of you take a job at a creation museum to do robotics?
Only as a subversive element. I mean, stuff like, hey, whoa, what, the dinosaur has three arms. Well, you know, mutation. Random. Right. Sorry.
Thank you, Miles. I keep a surprise at this museum because I bet it's going to be really cool if they're spending that much money on robotic dinosaurs. I'd like to see it.
Yeah, I still want to know, is there really a Tyrannosaurus in the Bible?
I don't know. I haven't read it. Have you read it?
A long time ago.
Okay,
need to read it again.
Anybody else read the Bible?
They kind of skip over exactly what.
Yeah, I read a lot of the Bible.
They don't go into great detail about, you know, and then the
it is a very confusing book.
It's because you need to interpret it.
Well, only some parts. There are other parts that are.
I mean, if you read it as science fiction, I don't know, it kind of works.
Okay, we're going to get a huge amount of hate mail now.
Okay,
it's just no. You really things happen, and you go, how? What? It's just it's so out there sometimes. You really, I guess somebody
turned into a pillar.
You know
what?
We have lost our expertise. We have gone off into a world we don't know anything about. So let's get back into the geek news.
But I'm confused by a lot of things.
Sean, you got another story for us today?
Yes. So the Arab Times has reported that a student has developed a technique for portable data where it can be stored on paper. So larger amounts of data.
Sorry, wait a second.
You mean like this? He says, holding up a printed out sheet
this
of paper.
Piece of paper?
It's called Rainbow Technology, and the guy's name is Zainul Abidin. He just finished his MCA at Muslim Education Society. He's able to store about 4.7 gigabytes of data on what he calls Rainbow Technology, Rainbow Versatile Disk. It's basically paper.
Okay, so you were able to print a whole bunch of data on paper.
Yes.
And
there's a
it?
Scanning Modify? Drive based on this Rainbow software that will come in smaller sizes, but basically would allow you to read the data off of the paper.
What kind of data density can you do?
How big a piece of paper is this? Is this like poster paper that's streaming down the Empire State Building, or is this an 8.5 by 11?
I don't know.
Well, let's see, a 600 DPI image. I mean, that's as much data as you can get, right? There's nothing special you can do. I guess it's color, too.
There are printers that do, like, 1,200.
Well, you're thinking of conventional paper, though.
That's true. But I'm just thinking, it does make sense. Like, if you could say, I want to print all my data and then have a book that's, you know, all your photos and your QuickTime, you know, it's a backup. It's a really good backup.
Okay, so it looks like it can hold 90 to 450 gigs of data.
Per page, or?
Yes.
See, that's a good way
to go. It's much lower cost, of course. So instead of using zeros and ones for computing, he uses geometric shapes such as circles, squares, and triangles for computing, which combine with various colors and preserve the data in images.
Very cool.
So the printout looks like, you know, a piece
abstract
of
art.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Now, how much data? You said gigabytes per sheet?
90 to 450 gigs of data.
See, that's beautiful.
As long as the paper is acid-free.
I apologize. I just came upon this story, as you said, Sean.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that.
And I wonder really how long the ink lasts.
Well, the fading would have to be really color...
Yeah, you keep it out of the sun, obviously.
The color fade would have to be pretty serious. But the idea of being able to print, you know, okay, here's my backup this month on a piece of paper and then mail it to grandma so you have it at a different location. I mean, you can have some really nice effects
here. But if you
here.
Fold the paper, though, that would probably cause a problem.
I don't know.
So you'd have to put it into, like, a manila envelope.
Even that would work pretty well, though. I mean, you could keep your backups with a deed to your house. I mean, you know, it becomes a piece of thing that is easy to deal with. Paper's a good longevity thing. I love the idea. I want one. We should contact
these people. It's definitely an issue because we currently don't have any digital storage that will last more than, 75 years?
Yeah, and CDs rot, so we've seen problems with CDs and DVDs.
So we may have a hole in history in 1,000 years.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Sean.
Unless we store on paper. We'll put the link up on GeekSpeak.
Good. Thanks for whipping that out of your hat there. I appreciate that bag of tricks. John?
I'd like to tie into Miles. Are you going to do the spam story?
Yes.
Oh, let's do spam.
Let's do the spam story.
Miles.
Go ahead, Miles.
Oh, okay.
What's up with spam? Why do I get so much spam?
Well, recently the reason we've been getting spam is because the Image spam has come out. I'm sure folks have seen this before, and they may not have recognized it as such.
You know, one of the things I love about this spam is that the first versions of it were really boring looking. Now it's beginning prettier and prettier. But please explain how it works.
It's an embedded image in the email. And because it's not loading from a remote site, it's not being blocked by most mail clients. And they're including text at the bottom of the email so that...
Random text.
Right. But the text is not quite random. It's pulling it from news headlines. So it's topical text, and it's grammatically correct, even though it's gibberish. And at the top, you have this image that's large enough so that when you open up your email message, it fills the entire screen. But it's text in the image.
So it looks like an email message.
Right. Standard HTML email message. And because it has this randomized text that's still grammatically correct and based upon stuff that's people will be talking about now, it's really hard for the standard Bayesian type filters to catch. And you have an image in there that, you know, a standard text scanner can't see. And if you do an OCR on that, it's a lot of CPU usage.
Optical character recognition.
Yeah, and spammers have been changing it so that it's a multi, an animated graphic, as it were. So it's actually the 15th frame that would be the stock pump and dump scheme.
Sure.
And so OCR is defeated on there. It's the really thing, quite ingenious.
The thing that's also bad is that these are larger messages. So you're talking about larger amounts of data being transferred, too.
Yeah, but they're not that huge.
They vary in size enough that you can't just block them and say, okay, anything within this range gets blocked, yeah.
The images have been fairly small.
You guys both work at a company that does some spam detection and dealing with spam. Mm-hmm. How are you dealing with this?
By a vastly increased call volume. People calling in and saying, blah. And we go, yeah, there has been a up to 450% increase in spam since June of this year.
That gets through all the filters.
No, just generally in traffic on the internet, there's been about a 450% increase of spam traffic on the internet since June of this year. And it has increased by, I don't know, just in the past month, we've seen the majority of that increase.
Yeah, and most spam filters are catching more than 90%.
Yeah.
But it's a numbers game. So if you catch 90%, you get 10% coming through. Our 10% is still 10%, but now it's a vast, you know, much larger amount.
Sure. Right. And here's some numbers to throw out. There are 70,000 infected machines out there that have been compromised by viruses capable of pumping out 1 billion messages a day.
Okay, are these, when you say these machines, these are the spam farms you're talking about, right? These are zombie farms.
Yeah, zombie PCs.
So people's computers that get taken over by some code, and then it becomes part of the spamming network. It actually sends out messages.
Yeah, people using Internet Explorer, going to the wrong website, their antivirus software doesn't catch it, or they don't have up-to-date antivirus software, and now they are part of the spam problem.
You guys had some great numbers about these bots, like what operating systems they are, what versions and stuff. Mm-hmm. Where does that come from? And is this going to be up on the site later?
I'll put a link up to it. Okay. So far, of all the ones that they are aware of, and these are the pump and dump spam Trojans, the ones where it's saying, buy this stock, it's a really good buy, and then you go and lose your money. Windows XP Service Pack 2 is a whopping 47.23% of all machines that have been infected.
Windows XP?
Service Pack 2. I would have thought it would have been Service Pack 1, but Service Pack 1 is only 21.92%.
Well, you know, they don't come out Service Packs quick enough. You know, and Service Pack 2 by itself doesn't take into account all of the individual updates that have been released in Pack 2.
Yeah.
Right,
they should release more service packs that take all the security updates.
Yeah, and none of people do the security updates.
The interesting thing, though,
is that
all these security updates, all of it, if you're still using Internet Explorer and you accept ActiveX components just by default, accidentally, you get infected. I mean, it's that easy.
Well,
right?
You don't even have to most of the time. You don't have to. You're not even prompted with the dialog box in many cases, many exploits for Internet Explorer.
Assuming they're using an exploit. But I'm saying, even if it's totally patched, there's no exploits, you go to a page that has an ActiveX component, you say yes to it, you've installed an application.
Right.
Right? So even...
But that's not what most...
most of it's
doing.
Actually taking advantage.
Most people are like, a lot of people do hit yes because they just don't bother reading the dialog box. But.
So what you're saying is that 47% of the bots out there are because of Windows XP Service Pack 2, and somehow it's being...
Or are hosted on machines that are running Windows XP.
What about
XP
the other
50%,
53%?
They're all flavors of Windows except for 0.05%. So you have Windows XP, the original release, Service Pack 1, Windows 98, Windows 2000.
How much of the spam bots, these you know, whole bunch of infected machines across the world, what percentage of those are the spam that we get?
I would wager
over 90.
Yeah, even go that's higher than that and say like 95-98%.
Okay, so what you're saying is that 95% of the spam you get comes from an infected Windows machine.
Yes.
Yep.
That is just depressing.
Yes.
That just makes me want to hate Windows.
This is totally why I've been talking about buy a Mac.
You know, the thing
people
is,
call
though,
in.
But yeah, but you know, Mac's only what 5% of the market. I mean, trying to get everybody.
Except for
on
the
it.
Fact that they are only 0.05% of the spam. I mean,
well,
actually,
included in
there's
that.
Actually
yeah,
other
the,
Windows versions.
Yeah, the
in there.
Other like you have all of this Windows. Windows is 99.95% of all spam bots. So anything besides Windows is 0.05,
which includes so. Versions of Windows Server. Windows Server is listed is not listed.
No, yes, it right. is. Windows 2003. Is 0.05% the same
I
as...
I want to get back to this in just a second. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered, office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. The Geeks this morning, Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is John Tracy.
KUSP co-sponsors the Kumbwa's presentation of Kahil El-Zabar's Ritual Trio with special guest Billy Bang. This performance will feature a current version of progressive improvisational music, eclectic in mood and influence. Violinist Billy Bang is considered at the forefront of jazz avant-garde. Performance is Monday, November 27th at 7 p.m. at the Kumbwa Jazz Center in Santa Cruz. For tickets and information, please call 427-2227 or online at www.kumbwajazz.org, and that's KUMBWAJazz.org.
Thank you, John. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Excuse me. Let's try that again. 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can send us email. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Rick Filman is awaiting your calls. I'm going to give those phone numbers out a minute, just a minute. So please do prepare yourself to call in, and we'll take any question on technology today. Anything you'd like to ask us, we'll be glad to confuse you about. GeekSpeak is supported by Cruzeo Internet, offering DSL broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. Cruzeo has retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and Watsonville. More information can be found online at cruzeo.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam, John Tracy, and Sean Cleveland. Please join the conversation. The phone numbers to do so are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go use our website, geekspeak.org, and click on Contact Us. All right. We were just talking about spam bots, and I find it fascinating. What is this? What's the solution to this problem, Miles?
The solution.
You know what it is? It's use an operating system that no one else uses.
Well, and be completely confused in doing
I'm sorry,
so.
Well,
a diversification,
if you look at
yes,
the,
is.
This pie chart, it's really broken down by, you know, the install base of these operating systems.
That's, yeah, that, to be
that's
fair,
true.
That's
completely true. But the thing is, wouldn't it be possible to
then.
Produce a...
Mac is at 6% install
no,
base.
Point.
Right. Yeah, right.
And over here,
it's 0.05% of the.
Well,
yeah.
But based on this, you know, this particular method of
okay,
collecting
so,
spam.
So here's the question. Well, I mean, we could get into the details of that, but let's not. The thing that I want to know about is if these machines have a vulnerability and then they're getting infected, couldn't a whole bunch of white hat spammers or hackers, if you will, make vulnerability exploits that turn off spamming from that
Some
machine?
People have tried doing that in the past. One,
beneficial
it's still illegal.
Viruses.
It's
yeah.
still illegal, sure.
It's still illegal because you're still trespassing on someone's
sure.
system using their... it's a tort offense. But at the same time, when they've tried it in the past, it's caused more problems than it solved because they will propagate very fast and you'll end up using network resources just like the bad viruses mm-hmm. or the... So,
well, what about this, Miles?
Or the bad
what
worms?
About all these? I mean, when I get a spam message, it's coming from an IP address. That IP address is owned by a person. What about the ability for me to contact that person somehow and say your machine's
it's
infected?
It's not here. Very easy. You can contact the ISP a lot easier than you can contact
and
the
individual ISPs.
User.
Why aren't the ISPs making it easier to detect which machines are infected? I mean, they're obviously sending messages all day long,
except
right?
for the fact that you have if you have 70,000 machines. Each machine doesn't need to send that many email messages. It may there are a lot
yeah,
of machines that will be
if
lost.
If I got spam and it was clearly spam, and I have the IP address of the sender, then I know which
you may
IP
not have
address.
The true, you may not have the IP address of the true sender.
Well,
you may have a relay.
Though, I think normally we do have the IP address.
Normally you have the relay.
Is that machine, Miles? Are these infected machines sending the message directly to my SMTP server?
They
or are they going through?
They used to, but now they're sending more to the ISP's SMTP server.
All right. So you see them coming from a legitimate relay. And a lot of times what happens is they're these giant lists.
RBL too, yeah.
Right, exactly. What Miles is just talking about, RBLs, are called real-time black hole lists. They're these giant lists kept of known spam servers.
Sure.
You can subscribe to these lists, and they update them. So, you know, if you get your issue resolved and you're no longer a spam server or a relay or whatever the problem was, you're taken off from the list. If you are sending out spam, you're put on this list. People can subscribe to these lists. Some are free, some are not, some are subscription-based. Your mail server that receives the mail can check against this. So as a message comes in, it can see, is that message coming from an IP address that's listed on this blacklist? If it is, it drops the connection, doesn't receive it at all. So if you use a blacklist, great, you drop out 60, 80% of the spam before it ever gets in. Problem is, sometimes legitimate servers, ISP servers that are sending out spam inadvertently, get put on these lists, and so they're blocked. Some lists are better at keeping that from happening than others. But
if you're asking for a solution, the solution is software needs to be made better. Like, for example, right now, the solution for most of the people who are infected is you need to back up your important data off of it, wipe the system, and start over again.
But you're going to get infected again, though.
But the thing is, you still have a prevention aspect to it,
Miles,
that needs to go into it.
Last week's show, we mentioned, we always mention, like, all the time, virus protection and other detection stuff of mm-hmm. vulnerabilities in your system and installing this stuff. Is there anything that you can run that will get rid of these things?
It depends. Remember when we had talked about my aversion to buying Sony products?
Yes.
Sony, a little while back, released a CD that had a rootkit on it. Mm-hmm. A rootkit being something that installs, patches the Windows kernel so that it would prevent you from ripping that CD. And it was done without your knowledge, without any prompting. It was as soon as you put that audio CD into your computer. And that opened up a hole for people to get exploited.
Oh.
And so it's this confluence of different items. It's not, and those are things that the antivirus vendors can't really handle, or rootkits. They can't handle them well. Each one's going to be different, and a rootkit, by definition, is going to tell the operating system, yeah, when someone asks for me, tell them I'm not here.
Okay, so how do people deal with this? I mean, I know how to wipe my Windows machine and save my data and reinstall, but not most
it's
people
not
don't.
An easy, there's no easy answer to it.
And that's why
and backups.
And that's why there's a billion spam messages being sent a day.
Yeah, and backups are much more painful than they used to be.
Yeah.
It used to be you get like a Colorado tape backup system, the Jumbo 250, you know, and you plug it in and you go and you're done.
And you backed up all 4 gigabytes of your data.
It's amazing.
All 200 megabytes of your data. But nowadays, backing up is a big deal. What do you do with all of your MP3s, all of your videos?
I think there's one thing we can do about spam. Stop clicking on spam links. Stop buying things from spammers. The money will go away. They will stop sending spam if there is no money.
Thank you. Let's hope that will work. From Santa Cruz, Ted, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there.
Please please ask us a question that we can help with.
Yes. Well, I heard about this king in Nigeria. I was wondering if I should send him my credit card number. No. Sorry. Actually, I have been asked by more and more people to give advice, and so I'm turning to you folks for advice. Intel versus AMD.
Intel.
Okay, without a doubt.
Yep.
No, not necessarily.
He just wanted to wake Sean up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's been my instinct. I'm wondering, what I've heard from various geeky friends of mine is if you are geeky enough to tweak the system and if you like to overclock and things like that, then go AMD. But if you want stable, secure, don't have to worry about it, stick with Intel.
Actually, Intel is the overclocking platform right now.
It is so hard to overclock an AMD system. It's not
okay.
Funny.
Well,
but if you're geeky enough, yeah, you can.
Right. Well, okay, now I'm looking for the non-geeky, you know, for just
regular don't overclock
person who
then.
Wouldn't want to listen to this show because they don't know what the heck we're all talking
right
about.
Right now, when it comes down to floating point performance, you know, if you're into gaming or ripping video, you know, anything.
If you want
really
a
uses
machine.
Your computer, uh-huh. then Core 2 really makes a difference.
Okay.
And that's Intel.
Yeah.
Right.
But, you know, if you're just surfing the internet and writing Word documents, and you really don't care about really high-end you know, enthusiast level features, then
basically if you're not playing the newest games,
then it doesn't matter what you use. Yeah. I mean, AMD processor is plenty fast enough.
I have an AMD machine at home, and it's my primary Windows machine, and it runs beautifully, and it's wonderful. And we tested it recently with an Intel Core Duo, or Intel
Core 2 Duo,
Core 2 Duo, uh-huh. And Intel Core 2 Duo just kicked its butt. But that doesn't, it didn't really affect it, except for like an ego thing for me. You know, I don't see it. I don't see the performance difference.
But you know, if you really want to drop $1,000 on a processor, I think right now I'd recommend getting the new quad core.
Which is they already have that on a processor.
Anyone want to spend $1,000?
So Intel's quad core chip only runs at 2.6 gigahertz, where the Core 2 Duo runs at 2.9. So right now the Core 2 Duo is faster. But you can overclock the quad core, and you'll have four cores later on when applications finally start becoming multi-threaded, which they're really not, except the workstation-level stuff. But you know, what it comes down to is games need to become multi-threaded. Yeah. When games become multi-threaded, I think people really start looking at multiple cores. But you know, you're better off just spending $300 on a Core 2 Duo. I would go for a 4-meg chip, 4-meg cache chip. Because
you know,
the really cheap ones only have 2
for
meg.
For most folks, I'm thinking the $60 Sempron would work for folks.
Yeah, for most people.
Yeah. True, most people.
Well, that's sort of my question. So obviously gaming and video is high demand. But for the regular user, someone who's not geeky and isn't going to be doing anything powerful, are AMDs comparable in terms of stability and dependability?
Oh, sure.
And price for performance? Yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then in the Intel world, how about Celeron or not Celeron?
Don't even go there at all. I would not recommend a Celeron.
Uh-huh.
You know, just spend $50 and get yourself a processor that doesn't have crippled cache. I'm serious. Celeron's crippled.
One of the geeks is saying his AMD Sempron 2.8 Plus runs Battlefield 2 just fine.
Yeah. You know, for gaming,
games,
what really makes a difference is
the video card.
The video card, your GPU. Right. And also system memory is important.
Now, Ted, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Now, we talked about Vista for a few weeks now. We've been talking about Vista, and one of the things about buying a new machine, and right now you're not going to get a machine with Vista on it, but you'll get a promise that Vista is capable. There's two different versions. There's capable, which means it kind of runs crippled, and then there's premium ready, which runs fully. So if you're going to buy a new computer, make sure that it can do premium ready Vista.
Well, there's also ultimate. Capable.
An ultimate?
Yeah, there's Vista Ultimate.
Yeah, that's everything. That's all the bells and whistles. There's five different versions, really. But right now, the recommendations are Vista Capable and Vista Premium Ready. It's Premium Ready.
Premium Ready is the one
and
you want.
And Premium Ready means you get all the graphics. And what's important for the Premium Ready system is that it's got a dedicated GPU with enough graphics memory that you can run all the 3D elements of the desktop.
So the real solution to figuring out a Windows machine, if you're going to buy a Windows machine, go up to Wikipedia, look up Windows Vista, read that. Because that will tell you what's going on, and you'll understand what's happening. All right, from Gilroy, Jose, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, how you doing?
Whoa, can you please turn your radio down? Hi.
I'm up there.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, the reason I was because, I mean, I have this gateway, and I'm not too into the computer devices and so much and so forth, but a couple months back, I had this really bad virus. I think it was a Trojan. And that thing just started eating away at my computer, man. I just had pop-ups left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually I called the Geek Squad because, I mean, I bought my computer from Best Buy.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came and started fixing it. And they hooked it up with Webloop, the Spy Sweeper. And
okay.
then I ended up getting the Norton antivirus as well. And, you know, to this day when I go into my emails, I get these the stuff you guys are talking about, these things like people trying to sell me stocks. And what I was wondering, if every time I click on those, do I download like some sort of virus? Or because it feels like every time I keep getting more and more of them.
You're going to get more and more. That's not a function of spyware or anything. That's just a function of there's more of those spam out there.
Right. Now, as far as the email is concerned, those image spams, you shouldn't click on any link inside of a spam. That's just a general rule. It doesn't matter if it's the image spam or any other type of spam. If you see it spam, don't ever click on a link that's in that spam. Just go to your delete button in your mail client and delete the email and forget about it.
All right. Hey, every now and then, I mean, this is just like, it was funny to me. Like, these guys give me stuff, and I would write stuff back to them, telling them, like, get a life and stuff that I was ever wondering. Do they ever get those mails when I send it to them?
No, but you do confirm that your mail address exists.
And it may take you to a web page that does have, for example, an Internet Explorer exploit or something like that, something that you could download or an ActiveX control. So that's something to watch out for.
So quick question. Is there anything else I should get instead to protect my computer?
You should stop using Internet Explorer and only use an alternative browser such as Opera or Mozilla Firefox.
Firefox. Someone told me that was a good one, too.
Yeah. No, another method that that spam people use to see if your email is real or not is they embed a remote image. And then when you open the email, the image is brought up and they say, oh, you know, they actually got my image, so it must be real.
Right. So what program do you use for email?
For email, I have AOL.
Okay. That's handled server side. Shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah. So, but I mean, a good friend of mine tells me I'm like stuck in the Middle Ages because he has a different type of email. Forget what it is, but he says, like, it's so much more advanced than
You could use your web browser once you get the new one and go to Mozilla.org and, I'm sorry, go to, like, Yahoo and open a new email account there and try a web email. It's a good thing to try. It's free.
Yeah, it has AOL.
Is it safer than AOL?
AOL's been doing a pretty good job. You're doing a pretty good job. Yeah. So you should be
okay there. Thank you so much for the call. Bye-bye, Jose.
Thank you.
All right, we'll take another call from Salinas. Warren, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello?
Hello, Warren.
Yeah, this is Warren from Salinas.
Please. What's your question today?
Well, I'm thinking of buying a new laptop. Right now I have a Sony, which is about 3 years old. I really like it because the screen is great, but it's also got a desktop processor, so I get like an hour and 15 minutes worth of battery life. So I can't even watch a DVD. And I'm trying to decide if I want to go with another Windows machine or something else like an Apple.
What are you going to be using the laptop for?
Probably 95% of it is web surfing and email.
And what are your prime requirements? You're looking for something lightweight, something with a good battery life, something that can play games now and again?
Well, this one I have now is too heavy. It weighs like 11 pounds without the charger. So I want something lighter, but I don't want it to be too slow.
How big a screen do you want?
I could probably deal with a 15.4 wide screen. I mean, a 17 would be nice, but then it gets a bit hard to carry around.
Right.
The one I have now is a 16.1, which I think Sony's the only one that ever did
that.
Okay,
geeks, do you guys know any good 15-inch laptop recommendations?
I'm definitely going with the Mac at this point. I mean, he's talking about web browsing and email, and that's it.
Uh-huh.
And we just talked about all the exploits that were out there. If you're not playing games or doing anything that's requiring Windows software, I'd say get a Mac.
Whatever.
Well, my main question is I'm not that familiar with Apple.
Yeah.
And I need something that's easy to read because I don't have that great of vision.
Uh-huh. Oh, get a PC. And Macs, you just can't read them.
Okay, Sean is kidding in that one. But.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at some deals on some slightly older Macs, which wouldn't be a problem. It doesn't have to be the fastest thing, but I mean, they're like 12-inch screens, and I'm thinking,
I'm using one that's at least, what, 4 years old?
Yeah.
Something like that. It's a 15-inch screen. I love it.
They have a 15-inch and a 17-inch.
Yeah, and they're like, what, like $2,000?
They are.
Not the used ones.
That's true. You can go up on eBay and find them cheaper, but then, of course, you're taking the eBay risk. What about in the Windows realm? What would you recommend, Sean?
I haven't bought a notebook in a while.
I know.
Toshiba.
I mean, I'm looking at an Alienware.
Sony Vaio is really nice.
Windows, Dell. I want a nice machine.
If you go Alienware, you get a very nice
machine.
That's like a gaming
A buddy of mine just bought an Alienware system, and he didn't spend that much money on it. He loves it.
Yeah, the one that I'm looking at, specking them out on their website, are costing me about $1,200.
If you're willing to pay that and you get an Alienware machine, you're not going to go wrong with that. Warren, good luck with your purchase.
I would look at Alienware.
Is Alienware Dell now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
We are taking calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You're welcome to call in. Rick is standing by. Again, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or 1-800-655-KUSP. This is GeekSpeak. Gene from Santa Cruz, howdy.
Hi. How you boys doing?
Quite well. What's your question?
There was a power interruption while my computer was starting, and later in the day I went to start boot it again, and it wouldn't. It just boots to a dark screen with a hyphen blinking in the upper left-hand corner, and it stops there.
A hyphen blinking in the upper left-hand corner?
Mm-hmm. I can't access a safe mode. It will go into setup. It's the operating system is XP Professional. And I wonder, can you suggest anything I might do, besides hire somebody to fix it, to get it going again?
Okay. Do you have the CD, the setup CDs?
No, okay. I have nothing.
Yeah, it sounds like your machine's been. It sounds like you need to run in system install, and it will actually do a repair for you. It will detect that the operating system is still there, and one of the choices is to do a repair. You need to get a Windows CD that matches your operating system and go through that step, because in the boot cycle, something messed up in your machine.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen it boot into just a hyphen. Assuming that it's not really a hyphen, that it's actually a prompt, a DOS prompt, you could try to run win, W-I-N, and see if Windows starts, but I doubt that will actually
work. Well, nothing will type in,
okay.
So it's not a command window.
You're going to have to get a CD that matches your operating system, probably like Windows XP Home, and go for the and use it like you're installing the machine new. It should detect it. Just make sure when you're going through that process, if it ever says erase what's here, don't do that. Make sure you choose something like restore Windows. But the other way to go about this...
Then it would just affect the operating system, and maybe I would still have all my data?
No, yeah, it'll probably repair your operating system. There's the Windows install process actually detects an operating system that's already there, and it will try to repair it. So that will happen for you kind of by the defaults that you go through. Just make sure you read through it. If you really want to be safe about this, though, take this into somebody else. They'll pull the drive out of your machine. They'll put it in another machine. They'll yank the data off of it, and then they'll start playing, which is probably the best way to go.
Yeah, that sounds like good advice.
And you're in Santa Cruz, Gene?
Yes.
Well, Santa Cruz Electronics underwrites the show, so I wouldn't hesitate to recommend them. John Bauer's a good guy who runs the business. So good luck, and let us know how it goes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gene.
Bye.
Yeah, power failure on a boot up. That's always bad. That's always a bad thing. Getting a USB, really an altered power supply. UPS? Yeah, UPS. Very good thing to do.
Josh sent us an email about spam, mm-hmm. and he recommends using Gmail. And I forgot. Gmail has actually got really good spam filtering.
It's got great.
I've used Gmail since way back in the day, and I've gotten maybe 5 spam messages the entire time.
I was talking with came in this earlier this week and hung out with Josh here at the station. Josh does a lot of the tech here at KUSP, and he was showing me his use of Gmail. He's got all these Firefox extensions, which makes it like a real email client. It's amazing. Yeah, it's a very functional email client as you install Firefox extensions. And I threatened to invite him on the show to just go over, like, really pimping out Gmail because he seems to know how to do it so well. But that's the one thing is that their spam filtering is just rock solid because they're looking at a mass amount of mail and seeing what people say is spam and what's not, and they're using that as their algorithm base. And, of course, Google's pretty good at, indexing data.
Do you still need an invite to get Gmail?
I don't know if you need an invite or not.
I still have 100 invites left, so you must.
Okay, so if you want an Here's a blanket statement I'm doing. If you want a Gmail invite, please go ahead and go to geekspeak.org and send a geeks a message asking so, and one of us will give you an invite.
Probably got like 500 or 600 between us.
You probably get an invite from all of us.
Assuming, of course, that we trust that you're not going to do bad things on Gmail. So, one more call from Marina.
You know, I use Gmail to send large files.
Yeah.
It works great.
That's why I recommend everyone send pictures to me, because you can receive a 10 megabyte message and then you have tons of
storage. And they don't want you to delete them. They want you to have email history.
They want to index them so they know.
And all this is being paid for by the ads that pop up on the side. So it's free, and from the sense of money in your pocket.
It pops up in a crazy stock price too, which I don't understand, but it works, huh?
So that's gmail.com, and if you need an invite, go to geekspeak.org. Okay, from Marina, Tom, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, Lyle. This is Tom. Yeah, I spoke to you on Monday. I was over at Santa Cruz.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Yeah, it was really good to see you.
Tom is an engineering major or instructor at Monterey Bay Peninsula College.
Right. Yeah.
All right, Tom. So what's
hey,
your question?
And I remember I called you a few years back about an Apache problem getting CGI running when it was 1.3, and I think you guys posted a sample. Config file.
I don't know if we would have posted it, but I definitely think we would have maybe sent it to you.
Well, it really helped anyway. But now it's Apache 2.0, and I'm having similar problems. And I'm just kind of looking for maybe some guidelines or anything.
Are you the root administrator on this Apache?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, CGI, I mean, I've got it running. What are you trying to execute? What kind of CGI script?
Well, just some basic stuff, but I just set up a new Fedora Core 4 and, trying to get it up and running. I sort of got the basic Apache thing going, but just getting the config file to kind of even do HTML in user directories, it was just being more of a hassle. It seemed like there's some new features, quite a lot of new features in the in Apache 2.0. So I added directory directives, to set it up for users, and I'm adding exec CGI options.
Are you pretty much getting it running? The only problem you're having is the executing CGI?
No, it's even more complicated than that, because I was working on this about 6 weeks ago. I was just trying to get up to speed here this morning, and I'm still sorting through what I was doing.
Since we kind of already have our email addresses, I'd be happy to send you a couple config files for Apache 2.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
It's always a good base to start from an example, and I've got
something
a couple
that
servers
works,
running.
Yeah.
All right, I'll do that, Tom. That sounds like a good thing to do. Thank you so much for calling up.
So I just send you an email?
Yeah, please do.
Cool.
All right.
Yeah, good. Thanks.
Tom.
Yeah, bye.
All right, Sean, you have some other ideas about the caller that called in about Windows boot problems?
You know, I came across an article about this guy who worked at Best Buy in the Geek Squad, and he had been fixing a lot of machines with this issue, and he figured out a way that when you boot to the Windows XP CD, the first recovery method takes you to a command prompt, and he figured out a way to fix the Windows boot partition and the Windows base system files through a couple magic keystrokes. I got to dig that article up because it was very cool.
Yeah, it sounds like it'd be perfect.
It would be perfect. So, I think I have that bookmarked at home. I've been trying to rack my brain to see if I Googled this, what would it be under, and I have no idea.
Yeah.
So, we'll look that up, and I'll get it on the website today.
Really?
So what he should do is just send us an email.
Well, he doesn't have a computer that works, so I'll go to friends to send an email.
If you can send an email, go to geekspeak.org and send an email to us.
And that's Gene from Santa Cruz.
And we'll try and get that information to you. Not going to be, straightforward and simple, but this instructions are really good.
All right. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning, Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, John Tracy, and, of course, we had Alex on AIM helping us out the entire time, and Rick Philman answering phones. To all of you geeks, thank you for making Geek Speak work every week.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Miles?
He's busy.
What? I'm busy, man.
GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. All of you for listening to GeekSpeak, thank you so much. And for those that called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out. And, who wants to listen to that? GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Oh, next week on GeekSpeak, we have a show planned out. Anybody? Oh, we're going to be talking about, from one of the creators of Ars Technica, we're going to be talking about processors, how the computer works. And it's a new book that he's got out, and I don't have that information in front of me, but next week, all about processors and how computers work. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, or on the web at kusp.org. Coming up next is Castle Cottage with Susan Freeman. For GeekSpeak and for KUSP, I'm Lyle Troxell.